And now, it's time for our weekly news round, Lutheran Radio News, with Paul Hill.
Nuns were pictured kissing a tiny, thumb-sized piece of wood believed to have been part of Jesus' manger, which arrived in Bethlehem 1,400 years after it was sent to Rome, just in time for the first day of Christmas. Cheerful crowds greeted the relic, which was a gift to the Pope, before a service of celebration at the Franciscan Church of St. Catherine, next to the Church of the Nativity, where Jesus is said to have been born. Young Palestinian scouts played bagpipes, and the crowd snapped pictures as a clergyman held the silver container containing the wood preserved inside and marched towards the church. Men rested their foreheads on the relic to receive a blessing in a highly emotive moment many Palestinians have only dreamed of. Yisca Harani, an Israeli expert on Christianity, said relics are useful for dispelling arguments that Jesus was more spiritual than a physical being. She claimed the objects return in a statement saying the Vatican and the Holy Land are together. Brother Francesco Patton, the custodian of the Franciscan Order and the Holy Land, said the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, had asked the Pope Francis to borrow the entire manger, but the Pope decided to send a teeny portion of it to stay permanently in Bethlehem. He told Wafa that it's a great joy that the relic gets to return to its original place. A wooden structure that Christians believe was part of the manger where Jesus was born was sent by Saint Sophronius, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, to Pope Theodore I in the 640s, around the time of the Muslim conquest of the Holy Land. The thumb-sized wooden piece was unveiled to worshippers at the Notre Dame Church in Jerusalem for a day of celebrations and prayer. Around 50 worshippers attended a special mass with the relic on display yesterday. The Palestinian Prime Minister and other officials will attend the lighting of a Christmas tree in the manger square outside the Church of the Nativity. Pope Francis arrived in Japan on Saturday ahead of a trip to Nagasaki to pay tribute to the victims of the atomic bomb dropped on the city during World War II. But he will also pay tribute to a lesser-known group of residents who, hundreds of years ago, were tortured and forced into hiding for their beliefs. In the 17th century, a man waits nervously in line to be called. When he hears his name, he steps forward, watched closely by local and government officials from the capital, who have been sent down specifically for the occasion. In front of the man is a small bronzed image fixed with the image of Jesus Christ on the cross. The man is told to step on it. If he does, it's a public declaration that he has given up his faith and he will live to see another day. If he doesn't, he could face execution, crucifixion, or torture, forced into boiling hot springs, or suspended upside down in a pit of excrement. Any sign of hesitation could cost him his life. This practice of stepping on Christian images, known as fumi, was widespread in the city of Nagasaki in the 17th century. Nagasaki, an important port city, was first introduced to Christianity around 1560, when Jesuit missionaries from Portugal began arriving in Japan. The Portuguese Empire was at the time one of the large maritime empires in the world, with bases everywhere from Africa to Asia. The Jesuit missionaries worked to convert the feudal lords of the area, some of whom recognized that converting to this foreign religion could help them gain trade support from the Portuguese. Many peasants under these feudal lords would also be made or influenced to convert to the religion, and by the early 17th century, the town had become the Rome of Japan. Nagasaki was basically established as a Christian city with parishes. Professor Kiri Paramore, professor of Asian Studies at the National University of Ireland, told the BBC. Nowhere else in Japan was as Christian as Nagasaki was. At its peak, there were up to 500,000 people in Nagasaki that identified as Christian. But, over time, Japan's political authorities decided the rapid growth of the religion posed a threat to the central government. They decided to crack down. They were looking to get rid of Christianity, but they were also looking to remove the foreigners as a political threat to security of the state, so the two things were related, said Mr. Paramore. In the latter half of the 16th century, 26 missionaries in Nagasaki were executed by crucifixion. This signaled the start of what would end up being a long period of persecution against Christians. In 1614, a strict nationwide ban on Christianity was issued. foreign missionaries were quickly expelled from the country. Those who refused to leave were arrested, killed, or forced to renounce the religion. Japan as a whole entered a period of isolation, cutting off almost all contact with other nations under the government of the time, the Togabuki Shogunate. Around the 1620s, authorities decided it wasn't enough to get rid of the religious leaders. They had to come up with a public way to root out the religion from the hearts of the people. The solution? The fumi. These were brass images, sometimes set in wooden boards, depicting either the Christ or Mary. Every single person that lived in Nagasaki was ordered to go through the practice of stepping on the fumi. Soon it became an annual practice carried out at the start of each year. It was an obligation. The commoners, the samurai, the Buddhist monks, even sick people couldn't miss it. They would bring the wooden board to their house. Every single person had to do this, said Martin Ramos, professor of Japanese studies at the École Francoise d'Extreme Orient. It was quite well thought out because at the time, Christians relied a lot on images. People prayed in front of an image, Mary, Jesus, so many thought that part of God was inside the image. It was a link to the divine. For them to tread upon this was something very fearful. But many eventually gave in and trampled on the fumi. If you examine an original fumi closely, one poignant detail is that the face of Christ has been completely worn away, reminding us of the countless feet that would have trampled on it, said Professor Simon Hull, an expert in Japanese Catholicism at Nagasaki Yunshin Catholic University. The Christians who refused to tread on the fumi were killed or, more commonly, tortured. They would sometimes torture them by hanging them over a pit filled with excrement. They would cut slits around their temples to release the pressure so they wouldn't die, said Mr. Paramore. The main aim of this torture was not so much to kill those who refused, but to break their resolve. Sometimes there was even a doctor present so that when a Christian being tortured looked likely to die, they would be nursed back to health before being tortured again, said Mr. Hull. An estimated 2,000 people did eventually die as martyrs, refusing to renounce their faith. Others pretended to renounce the faith, but still continued being Christian in secret. They would return home begging God to forgive them, said Mr. Hull. In one community, they would even burn the sandals they had worn, mixing the ashes with water before drinking it as an expression of their profound penitence. They eventually became known as Kakuri Kurishiken, or Hidden Christians. These people would still secretly practice things like baptism. They would give their children secret Portuguese Christian names like Paulo, Mario, and Isabella. They would celebrate Nativity, Easter, said Mr. Ramos. For more than 200 years, they had no contact with foreign missionaries, so it became a very local religion, something passed on to the next generation, said Mr. Ramos. By the end of the 19th century, Japan decided to open its borders again. In 1858, the fumi practice was abolished in Nagasaki. In 1873, Japan's long ban on Christianity was finally lifted, more than two centuries after it was first put in place. When Japan opened up its borders again, around 20,000 Christians reappeared and came out of hiding, said Mr. Mullins. In that sense, the fumi policies were effective. You'd gone from around 500,000 to 20,000 Christians. The Pope, during his visit to Nagasaki, stopped at a memorial dedicated to the 26 martyrs who died at the beginning of the persecution. Today, only around 1% of Japan's population of 126 million are Christians. The Christian community in Nagasaki remains one of the largest in the country. One of the paradoxes of Japanese Christian history is that if all Japanese Catholics have refused to trample on the fumi and instead chosen to die as martyrs, Christianity in Japan also would have died, said Mr. Hull. It is only because some made an existential decision to trample on the fumi, despite their belief this action was gravely sinful, that Christianity in Japan was able to survive. Christians are to blame for centuries of anti-Semitism which led to the Holocaust and prejudice in modern politics, the Church of England has said, offering its repentance. In an unprecedented 100-page report, the Church confesses that Christians have been guilty of promoting and fostering negative stereotypes of Jewish people that have contributed to grave suffering and injustice, dating to when early Christians blamed Jews for the death of Jesus. Reports said that Christian teaching had provided a fertile seedbed for murderous anti-Semitism over generations, explaining, within living memory, such ideas contributed to fostering the passive acquiescence, if not positive support, of many Christians in actions that led to the Holocaust. The report published today represents the first formal recognition on the part of the Church that it bears a considerable measure of responsibility for the spread of anti-Semitism. It also mentions anti-Semitism in modern British politics, found across the political spectrum on the left as well as on the right. Work began on the document in 2016. Its publication date was set before the general election was called, but the decision to release it during a campaign that has featured accusations of anti-Semitism has been described as extraordinary. The report does not mention the Labour Party or Jeremy Corbyn. It does state that some of the approaches and language used by pro-Palestinian advocates are indeed reminiscent of what could be called traditional anti-Semitism. Anthony Lerman, founder of the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, said this could be used as a stick to beat the Labour Party, even if not intended in that way. The Church said it felt such a report was already long overdue. The report says that some prayers and hymns still endorsed by the Church of England bear anti-Semitic sentiment, including in the Book of Common Prayer, which talks of the ignorance, hardness of heart and contempt shown by Jews, Turks, infidels and heretics. The English Church has a particular guilt, the report adds. The blood libel idea that Jews used the blood of Christian children in rituals was invented in England after the murder of the 12-year-old William of Norwich in 1144 and was encouraged by Church of England cathedrals. The report adds, in 1290, England became the first country to order the entire Jewish community to leave. The report, entitled God's Unfailing Word, Theological and Practical Perspectives on Christian-Jewish Relations, has been backed by the Most Reverend Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who writes in a foreword, "Too often in history, the Church has been responsible for and colluded in anti-Semitism, and the fact that anti-Semitic language and attacks are on the rise across the UK and Europe means we cannot be complacent." One section warns, "Christians need to be aware that some Jews continue to fear that Christianity is itself at root irredeemably anti-Semitic." The report also warns that anti-Semitism has caused fear and distress, especially for young Jews at university in the UK. The report notes that anti-Semitism existed before the birth of Christianity, but said that early Christians amplified it, noting some would find the seeds of Christian anti-Semitism within the New Testament itself, in the manner in which it represents Jewish opposition to Jesus and then to the early church. This led Christians to blame Jews for Jesus' death, laying a charge of collective guilt against the Jewish people for rejecting the Messiah and for deicide. It notes, "The centuries of Christian government in European history include a long catalogue of anti-Jewish measures, such as legal discrimination and periodic expulsion, alongside bouts of communal violence, leading in some cases to the massacre of entire communities." The report also contains strong criticism from Ephraim Mervis, the chief rabbi. In an afterword, he welcomes the report as sensitive and unequivocal in owning up to Christian guilt, but attacks the Church for failing to condemn Christian groups who target Jews for conversion to Christianity. He says that some Christians see Jews as quarry to be pursued and converted, and that there is within the Church of England a theological approach that is permissive of this behaviour. Anthony Julius, a lawyer who has written about anti-Semitism, said that the report showed a generalising level of abstraction. He would have expected a more empirical investigation into the views of church members today and was surprised to find no mention of Labour or Jeremy Corbyn. It was brave and admirable to include criticism from the chief rabbi. Essex is launching an attempt to reclaim the history of the Mayflower and attract American tourists to the county by opening up the Captain's House to the public. The Mayflower set sail from Plymouth in the UK to the New World in 1620, carrying the Pilgrim Fathers to North America, but the ship was registered in Harwich in Essex, where the man who led the journey, Christopher Jones, was born. The famous voyage's history is commonly associated with Plymouth in the UK, after its US landing site was named Plymouth Rock, which later developed into the town of Plymouth, Massachusetts. But now a district council in Essex wants to re-cement its links with the Mayflower after being lost out of the story. Harwich was where the Mayflower was registered, according to historians, and its captain Christopher Jones once lived in King's Head Street in the town before he died in 1622. Now his former home is being leased by Tendring District Council and will open to the public for the first time next year, 400 years after the ship's voyage. A significant part of the property has already been restored to its original features, the council said, and work will start to make it accessible and allow it to hold exhibits. Mike Caron, head of sport and leisure at Tendring District Council, said, "I think the beauty of this is, if Harwich had been lost out of the story to some degree in the US, this is the opportunity to re-cement those links." The ship first arrived in the US in November 1620 with 120 passengers on board. The first person to step ashore at Plymouth Rock was Harwich barrelmaker John Alden, whose descendants are said to include Marilyn Monroe and Dick Van Dyke. David Whittle, vice chairman of the Harwich Local History Group, said, "I don't want to decry Plymouth in any way. They are part of this thing." But he said it was only by chance that the Mayflower went to Plymouth after an accompanying ship sprang a leak and they both turned back. If this had not happened, Plymouth wouldn't have come into the equation, he said, adding, "If that hadn't happened and the two ships had gone across there, would there be a Plymouth Rock?" He said that people in America don't know about Harwich, and that visitors are absolutely astounded when they are told. A new visitor centre is being created in Harwich, and images will be projected onto Captain Jones's house on Friday as part of an international Mayflower 400 opening event called Illuminate, involving locations connected with the Mayflower. More than 30 million people can trace their ancestry back to the 102 passengers and about 30 crew of the ship, according to the Mayflower 400 website, which was established ahead of the anniversary year. Earlier this year, Plymouth faced another rival claim after a retired policeman suggested the journey actually began from a Cornish seaside port. Historian John Chapman said he'd found new evidence that the Mayflower, in fact, left from Devon's neighbouring County Cornwall. Mr. Chapman said research proved the ship stopped for fresh water in Newlyn as it headed for the New World, a theory long held by residents in the Cornish seaside port. He claimed the truth was uncovered by a respected librarian who died in 1989. However, Luke Pollard, who was elected the Labour MP for Plymouth Sutton and Devonport in 2017 and is standing in next month's general election, said he was not worried about Plymouth's historic claim to fame. Speaking in March, Mr. Pollard said, "The documentary evidence that Plymouth was the last English port the Pilgrims stopped at before their long voyage to America is considerable, and I don't fear our claim is at risk." Witchcraft child abuse cases have risen by a third in 2 years, as experts blame cultural sensitivity and political correctness as barriers to protecting children. Abuse of children based on faith or belief, which includes witchcraft, spirit possession, and black magic, increased from 1,460 to 1,950 cases between 2016-17 and 2018-19. This marks an increase of 34%, with councils dealing with the equivalent of 38 such cases a week. The figures published this week by the Local Government Association, the LGA, also show that the number of children identified by council through a social work assessment as either having or being at risk of female genital mutilation, FGM, has reached a record high, with 1,000 such cases in 2018-19, up 6% on the 940 cases in the previous year. This comes after a trial at the Old Bailey earlier this year, which saw a woman who mutilated her 3-year-old daughter became the first person in the UK to be found guilty of FGM. Responding to the figures, Nimco Ali, OBE, co-founder and CEO of the Five Foundation, the global partnership to end FGM, said, "This is so depressing." She added that while there is increasing awareness in reporting the issue, there is also a cultural sensitivity, political correctness, and fear of being accused of racism when it comes to authorities confronting the issues of witchcraft and FGM, which occur predominantly among West African communities, which have increasingly high birth rates. "I'm so angered by these figures," she said. "For so long, the political power that black people have had has been dismissed. People are scared to tackle FGM and witchcraft as they're scared of being accused of racism. But it's racist to ignore it. It's more racist to look away. It really hurts that we still have to tell people that black kids need protecting." The National FGM Centre, a joint initiative between the LGA and Barnardo's, said both sets of figures are hugely worrying, a significant national concern, and probably don't reflect the true prevalence of this hidden crime. The LGA said that the council's social workers will become better at identifying cases, and that work of the National FGM Centre, which provides services for children and their families affected by FGM and abuse linked to faith or belief, is vital. Lisa Oakley, chair of the National Working Group for Child Abuse Linked to Faith or Belief, associate professor, University of Chester, said that the LGA figures were concerning and added that they may be underestimations. "The figures do demonstrate the need for more effective education, awareness, prevention, intervention and response," she said. "To develop these in the area of child abuse linked to faith and belief requires significant financial investment, which is not currently in place." The mother of a three-year-old girl has become the first person to be convicted of FGM in the UK following a foul bid to shut up her accusers with witchcraft. The Ugandan woman, 37, and her Ghanaian partner, 43, both from Walthamstow, East London, were accused of cutting their daughter over the 2017 summer bank holiday. 40 limes and other fruit were found with pieces of paper with names written on them stuffed inside, including those of police officers and a social worker involved in the investigation. The spells and curses intended to deter police and social workers from investigating were found at the Ugandan woman's home, the trial heard. Police also found two cow tongues bound in wire with nails and a small blunt knife embedded in them when searching the Ugandan woman's home. There was also a jar with a picture of a social worker in pepper found hidden behind the toilet in the bathroom. Ethan Bartholomew, head of the National FGM Centre, said, "There are many reasons why a child might be accused of witchcraft or that they are possessed by an evil spirit. When people are experiencing misfortunes such as poverty, ill physical health or have mental health needs, a child could be blamed for this. There are a number of factors as to why local authorities are discovering more cases. The National FGM Centre is providing more training for local authorities and communities in England, which has led to an increased awareness around the issue, enabling professionals and communities to better identify cases. The LGA said the next government needs to ensure councils have the funding needed to continue to take effective action to keep children safe from harm and abuse. The Christmas tree is up at the entrance to the Imperial Hotel in Jerusalem, but for its Palestinian hosts, there is little festive cheer amid fears that they could be evicted in favour of Israeli settlers. The hotel at the corner of Jaffa Gate in the Christian quarter of the walled old city is at the centre of a years-long ownership dispute between the settlers and the Palestinian tenants. In June, Israel's Supreme Court finally concluded that the settler organization Atarek Kohanim had legally bought the hotel, along with two other nearby buildings, from the Greek Orthodox Church in a controversial and secret 2004 deal. The church has long denied this, however, and the tenants say they have continued to pay rent monthly to the church authorities. Amid fears they could be turfed out at any moment, the tenants were last week given a temporary reprieve when another court froze the sale for at least 30 days, the Imperial's lawyer, Maha Hanna, said. While it appears he will still be there at least for Christmas, the proprietor of the 48-room hotel, Abu Walid Dijani, said he didn't know whether the decision would be a turning point or just another obstacle in the 15-year legal battle. "The story can end up forever and go to the garbage of history," he said, "or the settlers complete the process for their own benefit." The family has rented the hotel since 1949 and currently pays 200,000 shekels or $57,000 a year to the Greek Orthodox Church, he said. But Jijani says Atarek Kohanim is now demanding he pay rent retroactively for the past 15 years, 10 million shekels, that's 2.62 million euros in all. Money, he says, he simply doesn't have. After it, Kohanim said he didn't comment on an ongoing court case, while the church said it believed the ruling meant the entire eviction notice should be annulled. Property sales in Jerusalem are some of the most politically fraught in the world. Israel seized then entirely Palestinian East Jerusalem in the Six-Day War of 1967, and later annexed it in a move never recognized by the international community. It now considers the whole city its capital, citing Jewish, historical and biblical links. The Palestinians see East Jerusalem, including the Old City, as the capital of their future state, and view the growing Israeli-Jewish presence as an existential threat. The Greek Orthodox Church is the largest and wealthiest church in the Holy Land, commanding massive riches, largely in land portfolios dating back hundreds of years. It has faced repeated accusations of facilitating settlement growth by selling or leasing properties in Palestinian areas to Israel. In the 2004 deal, it is alleged to have sold properties to Atarit Cohenim, which works to Judaize East Jerusalem by purchasing real estate through front companies and then moving Jewish settlers in. When it was revealed, the sale triggered widespread Palestinian anger and led to the 2005 dismissal of Patriarch Irenaeus I. The church and the tenants have been fighting back ever since. Many Greek Orthodox Palestinians still accuse their church's leadership of undermining Palestinian connections to Jerusalem by selling property. The Israeli government is often wary of angering the Christian population in the city, aware of both Jerusalem's delicate balance and the need to retain the support of Christians in the United States and other countries. Hannah said the freeze is only for 30 days and was ordered due to Atarit Cohenim's failure to file some court papers in time. The Orthodox Church said in a statement it believed the court's latest decision means that all decisions and demands by settlers to Palestinian tenants to vacate the property became null and void, as the original Supreme Court ruling was based on invalid court decisions. Elif Sabag, a researcher specializing in the investments of the Greek Orthodox Church, said the delay was convenient for the current patriarch, Theophilus III. It allows him to appear as a victor on the eve of Christmas celebrations, he said. Yet Sabag said it may yet prove to be a Pyrrhic victory, and a source close to Atarit Cohenim said the organization was confident that the settlers would ultimately still take control of the buildings. A few yards from the Imperial, the Petra Hostel, another hotel in the case, is rapidly sliding into disrepair. The walls are peeling, the tiles are broken, and the bathrooms smell of mould. There are hardly any guests, and the few that are there look unimpressed. The Israeli authorities have banned all repairs until the case is finalized, a representative of the Petra Hostel said. Speaking on condition of anonymity, he said he didn't hold out much hope the latest decision would mean an end to their woes, saying he no longer trusted any party. They are all liars from 2004 until today we are fighting, he said. We may have won this battle, but not the war. And finally, one Sunday, Pastor Jamie was preaching about death and damnation, one of his favourite subjects. "There will be weeping," he thundered, "and wailing, and gnashing of teeth." An elderly lady on the front row stuck up her hand and objected that she didn't actually have any teeth. Pastor Jamie fixed her with a withering gaze. "Madam," he said slowly, "teeth will be provided." My name is Paul Hill. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Lutheran Radio News will be back next Friday. Until then, every blessing to you and goodbye for now.